Accession number 28351, Reel 1.
Lord Peter Blaker, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, Lord Blaker, to tell me something about your early life and your family. Whereabouts would you have been born?
I was born in Hong Kong, because my parents lived there for a very long time, my father for nearly 50 years. And he was sent there by his father. And when I say sent, I mean sent. He wasn't asked, would you like to go? He was told in 1910 by his father, who was a country parson, that that's what he was going to do. And the reasoning was this, that the country parson was the seventh or eighth child of a large family. And so the family law firm had been taken up, all the places there had been taken up, and various other jobs which he might have had were taken up by his seniors. So that may be why he became a parson, I don't know. I think he was probably a very good country parson. But when my father reached the age of 21, there was nothing very obvious for him to do, because there wasn't room for him in the family law firm either. And so grandfather, the parson, went to London to see his cousins who were in shipping in London. And they said, send the boy to China. There are great openings in China, 1910, just about the time of the Boxer Rebellion, I think. So perhaps they weren't quite right about the good openings. Anyway, off he went. No questions, no debate, no discussion. He was sent to London to the firm of Butterfield and Swire, now the Swire Group, who were very good people, especially in shipping. And he spent a year in London in their offices learning to read a balance sheet. And then off he went and stayed there for 49 years, apart from the First World War, when he and the young Swire, the son of the family who owned the firm, and he, my father, went to see the boss, and they said, we want to go and join up there. And this was in the autumn of 1914. And the answer was, well, I admire your spirit, but it's no use, because it's going to be over by Christmas. And so they said, oh, we didn't know about that. And so they went back to work. And in the spring of 1915, when clearly the forecast was wrong, they went to see the boss again, and he said, all right, young man, you can go, I admire your spirit. So off he went and spent 3 years in France in the Royal Sussex Regiment without a scratch, which was amazing. And then when he, when the war ended, he went back to Hong Kong, not with the Swire Group, but having bought with a friend of his a small company, which he remained with for the rest of his Hong Kong time. And I think he was a philosophical fellow. I don't think he would have chosen that career, but he would have liked to be a country lawyer, I think. But he accepted the fact and didn't complain, and did very well. Became the chairman of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, amongst other things.
And when did you come into the picture?
1922, I was born out there. And when I was seven, I was brought back to England, having had one holiday in England between zero and seven, and sent to a boarding school in England, as was my brother, who was 2 years younger than I was. He was only just reaching six. We were both sent to boarding school in England, because that was what was done in those days. Education in Hong Kong was not very great. Hong Kong was a very small place at that time. It was just one of many ports on the China coast.
I wonder if you could tell me something about your memory of Hong Kong. You know, as it, I know this would be a childhood memory, but what you're saying already is so interesting, that it was a very small place.
It was, yes, the population was small, and the activity was unimportant. I don't remember a great deal about that time. I have a few, as it were, snapshots. I have a snapshot of my father coming back from South China with a baby deer, which I think probably ended up on the table, but I knew nothing about that bit. I just was introduced to this charming little animal, which ran around in the garden for a while. I can remember the veranda on my parents' house, which was on the peak, right up on the high ground, the high hill, which is on Hong Kong Island, and the view down from that to the harbour, which was much bigger then than it is now, because at least it was wider, because the land has been filled in on each side of the harbour, so it made it much smaller. So I can remember that view, and I can remember very little else except the Peak Tram. The only way you could go up to that level in those days was by a funicular tram. I don't think you could drive up. And what has turned Hong Kong into the success it is firstly the entrepreneurial spirit of the people. Chinese are extremely good business people, and we're going to see that more and more in the coming years. But also the excellent administration of the British. But on the China coast at that time, there were many ports: Amoy, Swatow, Fuchao, Tientsin, Weihaiwei, all of them competing with one another. Shanghai, I haven't mentioned. Shanghai was then the big place. And then Mao Zedong did Hong Kong a very good turn, but the only place he did do a good turn, because he destroyed all those other ports on the China coast. None was left able to compete with Hong Kong, which was the only enterprising place on the China coast that was left, and that's why it boomed, combined with the spirit and the abilities of the people.
Did you find that the Royal Navy was a very important factor? And, you know, as a small boy, I wonder if it impinged at all on your consciousness, the naval activity there.
Oh, there was a lot of naval activity. It was, I think, possibly the base for the Far Eastern British fleet, but certainly the harbour was full of warships. That I do remember very well. Incidentally, while we're talking about the Navy, it is, I believe, too, and I've seen it reported as from the war records, Second World War records, that in 1945, when the Japanese surrendered on the 15th of August after the atomic bombs, the American Navy was going to go to Hong Kong, and the Americans were going to hand it over to the Chinese. And the Royal Navy got there first, which was fortunate.
So, going to school in England, was that very different? It must have been a very different life for a small boy from what you experienced in Hong Kong.
It was, yes. I loved school. I was upset when my parents went back to Hong Kong at the end of their leave. My father took leave every fourth year only, so I saw him only in the spring and summer holidays, every fourth year, and my mother every second year. That was the common practice. One has to remember that one couldn't fly in those days. I'm talking about the 1930s. The way you came was by sea. And it took a month to come from Hong Kong. It took a month to go back. So, I mean, that took up the whole of even the summer holidays. So one just stayed here, and one's parents came for 6 months when they had leave.
Did that affect in any way your relationship with your parents?
It did. It made me rather formal, rather distant with them. I mean, they weren't around to hug me for 18 months at a time. My brother and I were looked after by an elderly lady, kind, but she was a bit older than would have been helpful, because her own children were grown up. They were sort of 30 or something like that. So she wasn't of the age when a mother would normally have children of 6 and 7. So that was rather a formal upbringing. She was not very good at communication, and she wasn't very good at warmth. She was divorced, which I think had distressed her a great deal. I never met her husband. She'd lived in Russia. Her husband had been in, I think, the oil business in Russia, or some business in Odessa. And that, I think, meant that she didn't know England all that well. So it was a holiday of golf and tennis. And I can remember living in Bexhill-on-Sea on the south coast, and I had a bicycle, as did my brother. And I would, when the weather was suitable, I would bicycle every morning to play tennis at Coudon Beach Tennis Club, and bicycle in the afternoon to play golf inland a bit. So I became quite good at tennis and golf, but I didn't read very much. And of course, there wasn't very much music at home. One didn't, both the gramophone existed, but I don't remember much music. So that, of course, had an influence on both the rest of my life. I've been a bit formal, I think, and not good at hugs.
Yes, I can understand. It would have been.
It was worse for
a very crucial part.
Yeah.
Yes,
it was worse for my brother. My parents had the, and it must have been true of many parents, they had the excruciating problem: do we leave them both, my brother and myself, he being only 6, myself being 8 by the time we went to school, do we leave them both together so that they can look after one another, or do we bring John, the younger one, back to Hong Kong for another 2 years and leave Peter, that's myself, at school without his brother? And they took what I think was the wrong decision, in the sense that they left us both in England. And my brother was really too young, and he wasn't happy, certainly for the first few years at school. But one thing which was different then from what it would be now in 2005 was that there were many children in the same situation, because the empire was flourishing. So at the prep school which we went to, boarding school, there were 40 boys altogether, and of them, I suppose, at least 8 were in the same situation. So we didn't feel we were being discriminated against.
Yes, that must have been quite important, that there were others.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Yes, one of the sort of downsides of empire, in a way,
yes,
split up, because one thinks of your family and what it must have meant to your parents, the sacrifice of your mother, for instance.
Awful.
Going back.
Awful for
my
mother and father. If one looks at their experiences, one realizes that they lived through an awful lot of pain, I mean mental pain, because my father, as I say, was in the First World War, 3 years. And then in 1941, he became a prisoner of war of the Japanese. And I mean prisoner of war, he was a Territorial Army officer, age 50, and spent 4 years in a Japanese prison camp. And between those two wars, there was only just over 20 years, which is the period which, it's shorter than the period which has elapsed since Mrs. Thatcher became Prime Minister.
Is
absolutely astonishing.
It is.
And my mother was engaged to somebody in the First World War who was killed on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So that came to an end. So she volunteered to become a VAD, that is a form of voluntary nurse, and was sent to France and spent several years in France in a hospital looking after the troops there. And then you get to the, in her case, to the Second World War, when, as I shall be saying, I think in a little while, we spent time in Canada. And father was back in Hong Kong. And when Hong Kong fell, the money was cut off. He wasn't able to send us any money to live on in Canada. So my mother took a job in a munitions factory. She was aged 50 or thereabouts, and worked for several years in a munitions factory just outside Toronto, because she needed the money. Mm-hmm. So yes. a pretty appalling experience.
Yes, to be born in that period.
Yes. I mean, if you compare it with what's happened since the Second World War,
yes.
What we've had in this country 50 years of peace, apart from occasional events like Iraq,
yes.
It's really quite different.
Yes.
And that is a tribute to the politicians, of whom I was not then one, after the Second World War, who arranged things in such a way that a similar war would not be repeated.
Important to remember that, I think, about your parents' generation,
yeah.
Isn't it? And particularly
yeah.
The people in empire, with
yeah.
the extra sacrifice of letting their children go.
Much so worse for the parents than certainly for myself. I remember the taillight of my parents' car as it drove away in the evening, leaving me and my brother behind. And that was an excruciatingly painful moment. But within a few days, I had settled down and was back playing the tennis and the golf, and not really pining, and enjoying school, because there were lots of entertaining people and lots of entertaining things to do. But my brother was not so fortunate. He was sent to school too young, really. He should have been taken back to Hong Kong when I was first left here. But there you are. I can understand why my parents made the decision they did.
I dare say, you know, when we go through your career, we will find this age factor is important when one's in the army and putting up with things, you know, whether you're a young soldier or a married man. And
yes. Oh, yes.
So this is an interesting theme, I think. But now that you're in England, where was your boarding school?
It was near where we now live in mid-Sussex. It was at Crawley.
Did it have a particular name?
Upland House. It doesn't exist anymore. So there is a very good school in the same building. It's called Cottesmore, where our son went. And of course, the school's now much bigger than they used to be. 50 was the standard size of a prep school in those days. Now it's more like 150.
So going on from boarding school, you know, your prep school, it was Shrewsbury, I believe.
Shrewsbury,
it?
I went to after that. I went to the boarding, to the prep school, and to Shrewsbury because my cousins had already been sent there. And they were in the same situation because their mother was in Hong Kong. My mother went to Hong Kong en route to New Zealand. She was a New Zealander, as was her sister. And she went to stay with her sister, who'd married a Hong Kong person. And she went to stay with her and met my father in Hong Kong. And so didn't go to New Zealand at that time. She went back later, but not very often.
So how was Shrewsbury? You know, did you settle in very well in Shrewsbury, having cousins there? Was it a good place to be?
Well, as I say, I liked school because there were so many interesting things to do, and I loved the sports. It was a very good classical school. I wanted to read modern languages. My parents told the school that I was to read modern languages, and I found myself on the classical side. and that wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I appealed to my housemaster to get it sorted out, and he said he couldn't do it. And so I wrote to my parents saying, please write to the headmaster to tell him there's been a mistake. So they wrote to him, and they received a reply saying, dear Mr. and Mrs. Blaker, I have received your letter. I note what you say. Nevertheless, your son remains on the classical side. Yours sincerely. And he was right, actually, because it was a very good classical school. It wasn't a very good modern languages school. So he did the right thing, but it was rather brutal.
What would the situation have been as war was brewing? Were you aware of what was going on in the sort of wider world? That, you know, for instance, 1938, the Munich crisis.
My first political recollection is of Hitler marching into the Rhineland, 1936. And I didn't know very much about politics or international affairs, but I was aware of the great concern this caused to grown-ups that I knew, the parents of other boys at the same school. I didn't know much about my own parents' feelings except what they said in their letters, and they were alarmed. But of course, at that time, the feeling against rearmament in this country was intense. The Peace Pledge Union, I think, as much as any other organization, led to the Second World War. And feeling in France, I understand, was the same, that we must not rearm because that leads to war, which of course is the opposite of the truth in my view. And we learned that after the Second World War. But at that time, there was a by-election in Fulham, which had been a Conservative seat. The Conservatives were in government, and they lost it in a by-election, a sensation. And this so shocked the government that they decided they couldn't openly rearm. The right thing to do would have been to respond to Hitler marching into the Rhineland in breach of the Versailles Treaty, would have been for Britain and France, America being out of the picture, having withdrawn to their side of the Atlantic when they rejected the League of Nations. The right thing for the British and the French to do would have been to say to Hitler, you get out of the Rhineland or we come in. And we know now from the German records, I understand, that if we had said that, Hitler would have got out. And that might have led him to believe that the British and the French did have some guts and some ability to prevent him running all over Europe. But he must have formed the impression that he had a free run. He could do what he liked. And so that led on to Munich, that led on to, yes, the Czechoslovakia, Austria.
All of which. Would you have been aware of this as a... You were a teenager then, weren't you?
Yes.
You were getting on.
I was, well, in 1936 I was 14.
14, yes.
Yes, but I was sufficiently aware to realize that something serious had happened. And then, of course, that made me more interested in what was going on. And by the time the Second World War occurred, I was very aware.
Do you remember the actual outbreak of war? Where you were,
yes.
And your, what you heard?
Yes, I heard Chamberlain on the radio. Absolutely, and I was then 16. And so it was extremely relevant to me, because unless the war ended within 2 years, I would be in the middle of it. And that's how it turned out. And I can remember discussing with contemporaries of mine at school in the spring of 1940, when France fell, how on earth we could ever end this war successfully, because Germany occupied almost all of France and the Low Countries, and we were on the other side of the Channel. So we doubted whether Germany could actually cross the Channel and invade England, but we didn't see how we could recapture France, for example. So we were very aware of of the war that's implicated for us at that time.
Yes, that's interesting, because you were just the age, weren't you, if the war was going to be a long one, to be involved. Did you have anything like an OTC at school to prepare you at Shrewsbury?
Yes. Yes, we did indeed. Very, very active.
And I wondered, you know, particularly in your case and other boys with their parents abroad, there must have been this extra concern about being cut off more from your homes, your parents.
Yes, that was certainly a concern.
Would your mother have been in Hong Kong at that time when war broke out?
Yes, she was. But of course, the Far Eastern War didn't break out until the end of 41, but they were certainly aware of the war in Europe. And she came on leave in 1940. She arrived, of course, before the fall of France, before Hitler swept through France. And she was in England when France fell. I must tell you about a political cartoon I saw quite a long time ago, I think about that time. And I can't remember who the cartoonist was. And it showed a picture of Clemenceau, Lloyd George, and Wilson, who were the leaders of the three successful countries, principal successful countries, in 1918. And I'm a great critic of the Versailles Treaty. I think it was a complete disaster. It was a treaty of revenge, because Clemenceau wanted revenge against the Germans for the War of 1870 and so on. And Lloyd George, I believe, didn't play a useful role. He had his mind on the forthcoming election, and he was, I would say, posturing. And Wilson was not very effective. Clemenceau knew what he wanted and was a very powerful character. So he got his treaty of revenge, which was a disaster in its consequences. And the cartoon I saw had these three politicians on one side of the picture, and on the other side of the picture was a baby with a ribbon round it labeled Class of 1940. And the caption was, "Do I hear a baby crying?" Amazing foresight by whoever it was. He got it almost right to within 1 year of what was going to happen from that treaty.
End of Field One, Lord Blaker.